Yes.
Same, you know, here in America, we hear about ethanol all the time. It's mm-hmm. the same concept with ethanol, too, right? Because you have to grow the corn, use the fertilizer that's made from oil and gas.
Biofuel.
You know, use the machines that are powered by gas to make mm-hmm. corn so we don't have to use gas.
Well, and if you use corn so you don't have to use gas and you continue to consume gas at the present rate, all the farmland would be taken to growing corn for gas and there'd be no farmland to grow food. So there'd be dead people driving around cars.
Yeah. If you consider that other vegetation doesn't represent an exploitable biomass.
Okay. Now we're into the peak oil. We're into the peak oil debate here with some passion, and I'm just going to say we're going to pass on. It's not that I'm scared or I'm weaseling out. It's just I don't want us to get diverted away from the overview entirely. But there'll be 25 minutes to come back to that.
Well, I just want to say one quick thing. Peak oil is not. There's controversy, and it's not the main issue. So if 9/11 truth becomes bogged down in peak oil too much, you're going to miss the point.
We have to somehow try to be aware of a multiplicity of simultaneous interlaced crisis issues. It's not 9/11 against peak oil.
Yeah, exactly.
9/11 was, in my opinion, and I'm devoting the rest of my life to 9/11 truth. 9/11 was a seminal, pivotal event that was foisted upon us, which put the agenda of the neocons into orbit, which in turn then is wrecks the environment, causes obscene amounts to be squandered on the military, and so on. At the same time that that horrible business is going on, and that these psychopathic oligarchians are doing their dirty work and planning all, God knows what for us, the fuel is running out also. Okay, human beings, if I may say, certainly include myself, we have trouble thinking about more than one thing at a time. And we've got a horrible tendency toward either-or thinking, false dichotomies. And so I'm not, and just peak oil alone would be enough to occupy us, I know, for the rest of the session. But we can't do it. So therefore I'm going to skip some more stuff that Kunstler is saying about, you know, abiotic oil is a dream. Hydrogen is a dream. Ethanol is a dream. None of these, even all the alternative sources of fuel you can name, including geothermal and solar, if all brought online on a crash basis, would still fall far short of replacing how civilization right now uses petroleum. There's just going to be at least a huge gap or shortfall as we go into the transition. Now, some people here just may not believe that, and let's just agree to disagree and talk about it out in the lobby. So we are entering, I think because of peak oil and also because of other things, a period of great instability and probably turbulence, and probably hardship. And because I don't think even people who don't believe there's such a thing as peak oil think that the energy situation is all hunky-dory. So the energy situation, the political situation, the situation with extreme militarism, the situation with extreme surveillance and covert activities, the situation regarding the squandering of one of our most precious resources, which is time. Think. We only have so much time on this earth. And think of how much time is squandered on distractions. Even worse than distractions. Distractions that hurt our health, our mental health and our physical health. Watching a large... I'm not against television, as you can't just blame television. I always say watch programs, not television. So when I say television, I mean the majority of programs on the majority of channels. And people are squandering this resource of their time. Sitting, watching that, and being brainwashed with a value system that's contrary to their own interests. So that's one of the serious problems we have, which almost no one ever mentions. The time problem on an individualized basis, as well as the planet, is on a ticking clock basis, too. Thank you so much. you're going to get a raise. So it's going to hit suburbia particularly hard. And the long emergency, and there's going to be a lot of recrimination. There's going to be a lot of anger. As the price of gas just keeps going up, and jobs become more scarce, and you know the whole ball of dirty wax, people are going to be looking for scapegoats. And maybe a lot of them will start to look more than they even have so far for strong leaders. And a certain number of people will be have a tendency to want fascism. And there'll be other people who don't. And so there's going to be tension between those two proximate two groups. It's already in evidence. I'm pretty sure everybody in this...
I live at home. I fight my parents every day about it.
It comes right down to the personal level. Absolutely. And I'm working on a feature film about 9/11, and there's a couple in it. And the woman has seen the light, shall we say, put it in religious terms. She gets it about 9/11. Husband said, "You're crazy. That's stupid. That's anti-American." And there's this tension between them all along. By the way, it gets resolved for him when he gets into a car accident and his car catches fire and he can't get anybody to come and put it out. He watches his whole car burn to a crisp and none of the metal melts or anything. And that's when the penny drops for him.
I'm having a fundraiser for that film at my home and on the day after the event in L.A., as well as for Bob Bowman. So if anyone's coming to L.A., come to our fundraiser.
Kathleen Rosenblatt, thank you. Right, that's I'm glad you're raising funds because none of us have been paid yet. So the road system probably will fall into disrepair. And road system, by the way, the interstate highway system, it's not like a continuum where you've got a road in tip-top condition and then it might be in a little less good condition until it's in horrible condition. You'll know from experience yourself with driving, especially in the northern states and so on, we get potholes and so on, that a road will very rapidly degrade into a hell of a bumpy affair. And as the funds are withdrawn and fewer people make car trips, which has already started, I read in USA Today that at the Memorial Holiday, no, it was New York Times, Memorial Holiday weekend, the number of trips was down and the length of the trips was shorter. So people keep stats on this. Travel industry watches this like a hawk. People are saying, geez, we can't afford to go all that far. In fact, some people say we can't afford to leave home at all. And so already there's a shrinkage going on. And when the interstate highway system pretty well collapses, it ain't going to be fun to drive, and finally it won't be possible. Well, meanwhile, the brilliant people who put this country into the position it's in, I'm talking about the corporations like General Motors and Firestone, that use devious methods to derail the local rail transit, to buy them out, close them down so they could build suburbia so that the rubber and gas and metal could be used, at the same time screwed the whole railway system. So this country... I speak as a Canadian, and ours isn't too much better, but it's a little better, not through virtue, but we have a small population and long distances, so we have a better rail system because of that. And here, the rail system, Bulgaria would be ashamed if it had your rail system. So anyway, what's going to happen? I'll come to Kunstler's final point in the long emergency article. He says, these are daunting and even dreadful prospects, various shortages and so on. The long emergency is going to be a tremendous trauma for the human race. We will not believe that this is happening to us, that 200 years of modernity can be brought to its knees by a worldwide power shortage. The survivors will have to cultivate a religion of hope, which Unitarians already have, I guess. a religion of hope. That is, a deep and comprehensive belief that humanity is worth carrying on. If there's a positive side to the stark changes coming our way, it may be the benefits of close communal relations, of having to really work intimately and physically with our neighbors to be part of an enterprise that really matters and be fully engaged in meaningful social enactments instead of being merely entertained to avoid boredom. Years from now, when we hear singing at all, we will hear ourselves and we will sing with our whole hearts. And I think I can see that future. I can feel it.
Amen.
Dependent on one another. So we have a multidimensional crisis, but one crisis we don't have is a spiritual crisis. Because this multidimensional crisis of militarism and all the rest of it will cause us, just as in any great emergency, some people show their worst side. They just kill and they stab and they grab and so on. And a lot of people, it raises them to the finest possibilities are of being a true, full human being. And I do feel that it's not a matter of giving ourselves a pat on the back, but I can't help but observe that people involved in the 9/11 Truth Movement, a very interesting and wonderful group, by the way, do have this sense of a cause larger than ourselves, which actually illuminates and energizes us, even as we look into the abyss. It's a kind of a double movement, and it's a paradox. We're doing well for time here. Now, my third point about an overview, how we're wired. I already mentioned the minority among us who are psychopaths, but what about the rest of us? Well, I've been reading a lot about this in preparation of research for my book. And chapter 3 of my book is called 2001 Ways to Avoid the Obvious. It's about denial. And so I read books like Mapping the Mind by Rita Carter and How the Mind Works by Steven Pinker, or How We Think, I forget, and Malcolm Gladwell's book Blink, and I'd always been interested in psychology anyway, so I have a lifetime amateur license as a psychologist. When I was at University of Michigan in 1960, I was on a fellowship, could take anything I wanted, and one of the courses I chose was persuasion and behavioral change. And by the way, the professor had some links with the CIA. But he would never tell us what they were. He would just say, there's stuff going on you wouldn't believe. Which is true, still true today. But anyway, how to put it? I have to, part of my outlook, I don't want to shove it down your throats, but after all, I was invited to be here, is that I don't think we're wired to survive. I don't think Homo sapiens sapiens is wired to survive. Consider that during the whole span of human history, most people have been hungry most of the time. Now, what that means is that most human beings, most days, the main thing they were thinking of is getting food for tomorrow or even later today. This does not lend itself to the evolution of a species that engages in long-term thinking. And also, there are some physical factors that are involved here. If you're very poor, as two-thirds of the world's people today are, that's why I didn't include them in the we, you're just scrabbling to get some firewood to burn, you know, not using your solar funnel, and some food to put over the fire. And that may take a long time. You may also have to walk 10 kilometers to get a little bit of dirty water and bring it back. So how much time does this leave for people to consider the larger picture, as we have the privilege and the luxury of doing and the responsibility of doing and the responsibility for doing something about what conclusions we come to? Well, most people don't have this luxury at all. So there are a number of factors that lend themselves to short-term thinking. Now, that's the bad news there. Now, the other bad news is right there. Because, as you know, we have a left brain and a right brain. Now, the left brain is so-called logical. It's all the dense neurons and everything, a great capacity for thinking. The right brain has fewer neurons. It's so-called pattern recognition, emotional side, creative side of the brain. Although on the left side, there's a little creative part near the language place, which is where imagination happens. Now, the problem here is that the right brain is very susceptible to stories. And that's why storytelling has been so important all through human history. Now, once a story is ingested, adopted, accepted, embraced, then the left brain will protect that story against contrary evidence. What Steven Pinker says is the left brain is a baloney generator. He says the brain is not the captain of the ship, it is the spin doctor. And you can see this. You know, you can relate it to 9/11. Has anyone met somebody or seen that horrid creature Gerald Posner say that Building 7 came down through fire because there were diesel tanks there that caught fire? How many people have heard that story? Okay, everyone's heard that story. Now, if just think, anybody who has the least acquaintanceship with 9/11 and specifically then Building 7 knows that, first of all, there's not an iota or a fragment or a shred of evidence that anybody saw these huge fires, these huge diesel fires. No one has reported they smelled diesel fuel. No one, and even if the whole building was totally engulfed with burning diesel fuel, it still wouldn't have fallen down. And diesel fuel doesn't burn that easily anyway. And it doesn't burn that hot. And yet people will say, that's what happened. The baloney generator is working overtime. Anybody who would believe that. But people go into a trance because they've been told by Gerald Posner that's what happened. And then the evidence is brought in to back up. The left brain says, yes, sir, I'll back up that story. And so we do rationalizations. In the chapter 3 of my book, which is about this, I every chapter except one starts off with a story. And the story of chapter 3 is how myself and Humuk, who's not here, he's a camera person in another session, and there were four of us sitting in this very nice restaurant pub near American University. No, there were six of us, I beg your pardon. We're two tables of three. And so we were all known to each other except one person. One woman was a friend of one of us. So the five of us had all been to the emergency DC convergence, truth convergence, and we're all having the same mind view, worldview about this as we share here. And this woman just came in out of the blue, and she's joining her friend. So Humuk had this binder that he carries around. And in the binder, he had a picture of one of the Twin Towers, and then he had a picture of that building in Madrid, Spain, that burned for 18 hours or something in February 2005 and never fell down. The Edificio Windsor, it was called. And so he opened this, and he said to the woman, now, she's a very nice woman, she's middle-aged, and she's an architect. So he said to her, how can you explain that this tower fell down after it only burned a little bit for an hour, and this building didn't burn down after it burned for 18 hours, very hot? And she said, because it didn't have fireproofing. Just like that. So I said, you just made that up, didn't you? And she said, yes. And it was all unconscious. There was no conscious thinking went on. It was just our brains having this dialogue. Because she was making up, I dissected this thing. She was making up an explanation that fit her prior concept of what she'd been told was the reason that that tower fell. And then I came along unknowingly and played the role of the Joker. What the Joker does, and I claim no virtue of this, because as I say, it's all involuntary. I played the role of Joker, which brings in a different frame of reference, which makes what the previous person said unsustainable. So then when I did that, and I did it in a nice way, they say Jokers are nice people, then she, and by the way, somebody is always... somebody's dignity is always at risk in these exchanges. So when Humuk showed her that, and she gave this answer, it was Humuk's dignity was on the line. Well, he showed these pictures, and she had an answer. Okay, so then I said, you just made that up, didn't you? Now, her dignity is on the line. Humuk's off the hook, okay? So then she figures out a way. She says, yes. Hey, that really was a quick answer for me. Now my dignity's on the line. This all just happens in seconds, which is without a beat, without missing a beat. That's how quickly it happened. And there's some point to all that. But anyway, this is how we think. And it's good because it can help make us, I recognize your hand, just go on, it can help make us humble. Because essentially, the notion of the unified self is a myth. It's an illusion. You know, we'll even say I'm at war with myself, or I'm of two minds about something. So our language betrays the fact that on a deep level we understand we're not a unified self. But what we don't understand is the left brain and the right brain are doing this dance all the time, and we're being screwed by it because the left brain keeps figuring out ways to back up cockamamie stories that we've been fed. You know, Santa Claus and on up. So I'll stop there. And that gentleman had his hand up first, and then there was a hand there.
It was just the fact that I think when she said yes, she took her dignity back.
I beg your pardon?
When she said yes, I think she took her dignity back. Yeah, I think she put something on you.
I think that's a good analysis. Mm-hmm. And by the way, there's a whole second analysis that I have in there to explain this exchange, which is a deeper one, comes from Arthur Koestler's work. But anyway, I just find it fascinating. And you, somewhere there, yeah.
Well, I think that the term sheeple has been used a lot. I think that the problem is that we all like to follow leaders. People want to feel secure in following their leaders. And who wants to believe that their government, that they have put all this trust in for years, are going to betray them? I did a very good job of raising my three children, sent one to Duke, one to Carolina, and one to NC State. And, you know, they all were prepared within the system to get very good, high-paying jobs. And now I'm telling them, hey, that ain't worth a shit. how do you change that whole framework? Because to begin to think about 9/11 and what really happened changes your whole course of life.
Yeah, and by the way, just an irrelevant digression to what you said. I read a cute novel, I think called American Hero. And did anybody read that, American Hero? Anyway, there's a guy in there talking to a Japanese. He's American, he's talking to a Japanese guy. And the Japanese guy says, you know, what about your family? And the guy says, well, I'm average. We have two kids. One's in graduate school. The other one's on probation. So you did better than him. Yeah.
Well, I just wanted to say, you mentioned the left brain, right brain split. It's more than just that, because I think about this stuff all the time. I hold, you know, coffee talks when I was down at U of I all the time. We talk about 9/11 truth. I was the only person who talked about it in Champaign, practically, it seemed like. I was sort of out. The rest of the progressive people hated me for it. But the other thing is, we're very strange. Western society is also very, for as much as we talk about unified mind and universalism, which actually has a very totalitarian bent going back all the way to Plato. Plato.
Yeah.
Plato's a seminal philosopher in the West. There's a lot of totalitarianism behind that unified mind theory. We're also extreme dualists. I mean, you go back to someone like Augustine for that, a very important thinker in the West. Our mind body. And we're very estranged from the needs of our body and mind-body harmony consciousness. That's why Eastern religions, even certain forms of Eastern Christianity, really have a lot better sense of that. And there needs to be, among a lot of people, an openness. Because a major monotheism, the Western Christianity, most of Judaism, and a good part of Islam has sort of become estranged from a lot of those spiritual realities.
I personally really like what you've said, especially pointing out the dangers of dualism, false dichotomies. By the way, the very phrase false dichotomy is an injured phrase because it includes the word false, which implies that the opposite is true. So can you have a true dichotomy, I suppose? Anyway, one thing, if I can retrieve the thought that's just over there, that has to do with the way we think. Oh, yes, it's this. That at this religious conference was held in Washington, D.C. late recently and has been observed otherwise in various places by various people, that if you are looking, indeed, to impose a dichotomy on our humanity, shall we say, we know you're manufacturing it knowingly. We're saying there are two kinds of people. Okay, we know that we just do that as a sort of an exercise. So if we were to proceed with that, what would be the most important duality? And it would be my contention that the most important duality cuts across all religions and all philosophies, and in fact is primarily a psychological phenomenon, and that is the difference between people who are sure they have the truth and they're going to hold on to it for whatever reason or reasons and probably impose it on others, and those of us, because I'm one, who say we need to be constantly seeking the truth and adjusting our outlook in light of evidence. And you can find every religion. You've got your fundamentalists and you've got your liberals. And sometimes in between you have your orthodox. Every religion you can name has these wings, shall we say. And then you find them in the general population at large. And so I've said enough.